Good morning. I think we'll go ahead and get started. One of our speakers is still on their way, but I'll still go ahead and introduce her and the Andersons who are here with us today. But first, thanks so much for getting up early and being here on this gray day after all our sunshine. We are so excited today. As most of you know, I think, with this J-PAL Summer Institute class, one of our hopes was that each week we would focus on a different topic and be able to look at it a little more in depth. And so today is the health and medical piece of the J-PAL component we've been talking about. And we have Dave and Chris Anderson here with us today, who are longtime First Press members. Dave is a doctor and a cardiologist here in the Bay Area, and through that met his lovely wife, Chris, who's an echo tech. And they've, in addition to the more traditional practices they've had here in the Bay Area, they've volunteered for the past 5 and 7 years, I believe, at La Clinica, which is just an amazing clinic in Oakland and a few other parts of the Bay Area that we've looked at a lot as just models to be thinking about as we look at ways First Press might be able to get engaged with healthcare locally. Our other speaker, who should be here any moment now, is Mwadi Mukengi, who works for the Global Fund for Women. I met her a few years ago when I was working with Heal Africa. Mwadi's been based here in San Francisco for a long time and is Congolese and works with the Global Fund for Women, overseeing all of their programs in Africa related to women, and has really brought a lot of vitality to that program of looking at things holistically, not just one piece as the silver bullet to solving problems for women, but really looking at things like barriers to healthcare and economic empowerment and all sorts of the political factors that can play into a woman getting access to healthcare and out of poverty. So we're excited to have her here with us today and joining us. She also lives in Oakland, so is an East Bayer like us. So to start, I would love to just open in prayer, and then we'll have the Andersons come. God, thank you for this opportunity today to go deeper and learn more about what you are doing around the world and here in our own community with regard to issues related to healthcare and people's access or lack of access to them. I pray that you would be in our conversation today and that you would open our hearts to what it is you're wanting us to hear. I pray for the Andersons and the work that they're doing at La Clinica, that you would give them strength and wisdom as they continue in this critical work. I pray for Mwadi as she travels around Africa and here in the States speaking to people, that you would open doors for her and that you would continue to be in this work that she's doing for women all over in a lot of different countries in Africa. I pray that you would be here with us today, and in your name I pray, amen. Dave and Chris, if you want to come. Or if one of you is coming first, that's great too.
Well, welcome. It's very nice to be here. I feel very honored to be sharing the podium with somebody with such a national, international reputation. You know, I don't think it takes much of a reading of the New Testament to see that Jesus had a very profound interest in the sick and the treatment of the sick. You can wonder why that is, but I certainly think it's because the sick represent humanity, us, at our neediest, at our most vulnerable, in pain. I think that's where God is interacting, exposes us, exposes our humanity. And I'm sure if Jesus were here today, he'd have that same interest. I don't think it was just something from Bible times. And as a result, I think we should have that same interest. We do care for the sick and have an interest in the sick in our corporate Christian state. We have pastors that do visitation. We do visitation as lay people. We pray for people. We make meals for families when they're sick. But I think in this complex society with this complex relationship that we now have, we need to involve ourselves in an understanding and have a deeper interest in healthcare in this country and in our communities. You know, gone are the days when healthcare was episodic, between individuals, about an individual problem, the payment of which was done on a very much more simple basis, maybe by barter in frequent cases. And that's good, because now we have complex disease management to take care of problems such as hypertension, diabetes, and prevent its long-term morbidity and issues of stroke and heart attack as a result, treatment of high cholesterol, and early detection of cancer, and in fact curing cancer and preventing premature death. So there's a lot of benefits to be gained from this kind of approach. But this complexity means that there's a very complex relationship between people and healthcare now. And it has to be delivered in an equitable manner so that everybody gets the benefit of this. And I think as Christians, we need to involve ourselves in the public debates about healthcare and how it's delivered, and support those that are really in keeping with our vision of what it means to be a Christian. And so I think it becomes very important. And I'd like to just give you some examples of things that I see every day, because I think that's part of the problem, that people don't understand what's going on. When Chris and I go down to La Clinica, that's where we volunteer, we'll talk a little bit about that later, we run into immigrants who are obviously poor. They're obviously sick, because that's why they're there. But added to that complexity is the complexity of they're worried about any interaction with any organization could lead to their deportation. You know, most of the people we see are in some state of illegality or have illegal family members. So that's a whole level of complexity that I think we need to be sensitive to. I'm part of a big cardiology group in the East Bay, and so we have offices all over. A big part of my practice is the inner city. So I frequently take care of poor people. And this is a group with many complex medical issues, diabetes, hypertension, substance abuse. And so it's hard to understand what it's like. But let me tell you, imagine yourself a 29-year-old mother of two. You're hardworking. You have two jobs, okay? But neither of them are benefited because they're both part-time. And now imagine you might have hypertension. Imagine your kid has asthma, okay? Imagine getting those meds. Imagine dental care for your two kids, not to mention yourself. So this is a common situation. Or imagine a mother of two. She's also a single mother, and she's given up in the job market. So she has Medi-Cal. Well, that's great. Makes care of primary needs. But just imagine getting those needs met. You go. You can't find a primary care physician because the fees to primary care physicians are so parsimonious under the Medi-Cal system that you have to get into some sort of clinic situation. And so you report to the clinic, and imagine DMV at its worst day. That's every day when you want to get, because you're worried about a sore throat or a lump in your breast or your kid's having more problems with asthma. And again, the whole dental issue. So that's somebody that is covered by Medi-Cal. But let's change the venue. Let's go to our neighborhood. So your neighborhood's a 53-year-old divorced woman. She's making it. She has a mortgage. She's staying in her house. She works as a mid-level manager at Macy's. And then there's some sort of Macy's restructuring, and she doesn't have a job anymore. She's 53. And a month later, she palpates some mass in her breast. Imagine the terror that she has knowing that she doesn't have health care. And now she's going to have to figure out how to get this evaluated and treated. And that's a very common thing. Or imagine the widow in our church. She has Medicare. That's great. But she has a fixed income. Maybe it's a little bit less than she thought because her husband's pension plan went belly up in the recent problem. So now she's, every time she goes to the doctor, some guy like me, is saying, well, there's another little problem. We want to tweak this. We want to tweak that. We're adding another medicine. There's another copayment. And that copayment starts eating into her fixed income to the point where she's cutting her pills in half. and taking half the dose that I think she's taken, and I was wondering why her cholesterol isn't under control, and she's skipping some meals. That's common. I see that all the time. So I don't have the answer for these things, and I don't think there is a answer, but these are problems that I think we as Christians, we need to be thinking about, and we need to analyze the propositions that are being put forward in terms of public policy, and I think we need to support those that are really in keeping with our faith, realizing that no one has the right answer, but there is an answer that is more just and more fair. And I think as Christians, that's what we're about, being just and fair. And I think we need to get involved in that discourse in a much better way. And I think it's not just about money and public discourse. I mean, there are things, there are ways that we can connect with the system. Chris and I had found a way that matches our skill set, our needs, their needs, not our needs, their needs, with our skill set. I'm a cardiologist. I speak Spanish. And I had had La Clinica would refer to our practice for their patients that had insurance. I knew them. I knew the people. I liked what they did. And so I began a few years ago volunteering for them. We have a clinic on once a month on a Saturday morning, and we see that as an organization, I'll tell you about the organization in a minute. They cover the bases with primary care, but they don't really have access to specialty care like a cardiologist. So I'm their cardiologist, and we have this clinic that we see patients. I convince them to add a cardiac echo package to their ultrasound machine. Chris is an expert echocardiographer. She used to run the program at UC. And so she comes in and she does the echoes while I'm doing the consultative work on Saturday mornings. And then I'm available to them by email, faxes, phones for urgent things during the week. And so they'll, a nurse practitioner will call me and say, I got a patient here with tachycardia, something like that. And we take care of that. So that's how we're involved. It's a large East Bay community organization with several locations going out to Concord and Brentwood, Antioch, started here in Oakland, whose mission is to deliver health care in a culturally appropriate way. They saw 80,000 patients last year, 80,000. 80% of those patients are below the poverty line. 95% of the patients are less than 64. 43% of the patients are kids. So it's dealing with young patients. 70% are Latino. 46% are self-pay. And that's done because it's made possible there are government and non-governmental programs that partner with them to figure out a way, how can we deliver primary care, dental care to these people, and then the patients pay some, they pay what they can, they have a pharmacy and the like. 42% are Medi-Cal, and then with the Affordable Care Act, the Medi-Cal role is going to grow, so organizations like this will become very important to pick up the slack there. So that's kind of an outline of kind of how I see it. I'd like Chris to come up and talk a little bit about what it's like on a morning at La Clinica, or what she sees, or what her vision is. I'd like to hear from her. I blabbed on.
Morning. Thank you very much for coming. I graduated from UC Berkeley in 72, and a friend of mine and I very much wanted to travel in Central and South America. So we left and traveled by bus and settled in a language school in San Jose, Costa Rica, and I studied there for a number of months. Karen was quite proficient already and traveled down into South America, and we met in Ecuador after, I guess it was 6 months of my studying there. While I was there, a major earthquake occurred in Guatemala, and I was very impressed that the people that could be of assistance were medical. And so when I returned from our trip, I wanted to head in a medical direction. I didn't want to be a nurse. I didn't feel smart enough to become a doctor. And a position opened up at John Muir in which I could, I did a night course in EKGs, and I started there doing EKGs. And then shortly after, they bought an echo machine. It was in the mid-70s, and not many people knew how to use it. So I paid my way to a course in Oregon, and with the help of a cardiologist that was there, we kind of worked on it together. And I loved the technique because I love photography. It's imaging the heart. It's a quiet time with the patient. It doesn't hurt, and it's a test that gives you a lot of data quickly. You're able to see the heart function, measure size, and now with Doppler, you're able to see blood flow, learn about if the valves, if there's leakage, if there's a hole in the heart. So it's a lot of data quickly, painlessly, and not very expensively. From John Muir, I went and was very thankful to get a very good job at VA Fort Miley directing the echo lab there and training the UC fellows that were coming through in this technique. David and I met there. And anyway, then just to give you the germ, how the idea of La Clinica started, when Joey and Leah were 10 and 11, we traveled a lot in Mexico, Central America as a young family. And one summer we went to Guanajuato and lived with a family and walked down the hill and started Spanish. David had a lot of French in his head and wasn't sure how he could get it out, but we took classes at different levels as a family. And then we came back and I bought David a used textbook from a UC Berkeley textbook. And he's a pretty good student, and he studied pretty hard, you know, on his own through this textbook. And then a friend of ours had a very good language tutor, lovely woman, Colombian. And after about a year, David signed on with her, and he's been with Luisa once a week for many years now. So after about... 3 or 4 years with Luisa, I would say David has become very conversant in Spanish, such that he is the East Bay Spanish-speaking cardiologist, which is kind of weird, kind of weird in a way, you know. So anyway, we work together, which is really wonderful on a Saturday morning. More often than not, we're able to reassure people. Their physician has heard a murmur, their primary care person or a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. We're able to reassure them. People that have maybe just gotten out of prison, that are working 3 jobs, they don't have any medical insurance whatsoever, or they're illegal. A young, illegal, dapper guy from El Salvador that is trying to make his way here. The doctors heard a murmur and were able to assess that he has a very large hole in his heart that needs critical care. He needs surgery. Or a young man that we've seen monthly that at one time in his life, you know, drank quite heavily, and he has an alcoholic cardiomyopathy. His heart is very large and non-functioning, and David's been able, step by step by step, he's now on the list at UCSF to receive a heart transplant. So those are the faces of the people we see. Not all are Spanish-speaking, but La Clinica has translators there with all kinds of dialects readily available, and it's a very satisfying morning for sure. And I think we're able to impart dignity to the patient there. They're seeing the real deal. They're getting expert care. They're going to get follow-up. They can come back to the clinic monthly. And it does. It's very satisfying to dignify a person with giving them the best of care. So, and it's wonderful that this little dream that started, you know, in Guanajuato, walking down this down the hill, and you know that it's just wonderful that it's kind of come together for us as a family and for David and his practice. It's been extremely satisfying. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll have a chance to ask questions at the end to the Andersons and Tim Waddy. I've already introduced you and read your bio, so if you want to come up and share with us, this is Mwadi Mukengi.
Thank you, Bridget. Good morning, everybody. I'm really happy to meet all of you and to officially meet La Clinica. I mean, I've heard of you for so many years and know of a colleague who works there, so it's good to hear from your own words how you began and some of the work that you do. And it seems really interesting to have this series at the church. I think it's really important for this kind of dialogue to happen, and so thank you for the invitation. There's definitely a very strong link between the local and the global, and Berkeley knows that. But let me give you some examples from my experience. I'm currently working at the Global Fund for Women, but I have a very global history, as you've heard. I'm from a country that doesn't have the types of services that we often find here. I'm from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And in my work, I've been also able to travel back and forth to various countries on the African continent, looking at how to strengthen civil society, and one of the ways looking at strengthening those organizations that offer health services. And I just want to touch upon a few health issues that have been really percolating on the continent. Definitely an attention to providing primary health care in the public sector. And unfortunately, we've shifted on the African continent from a system where the government provided a lot of the services to where there's a lot of cost sharing, but to a population that doesn't have the income to pay for it. So that's the contradiction there. And oftentimes, those kinds of arrangements are a product of some of the World Bank loans that are provided on the continent, you know, to actually have less government and contribution to the health and education sector. Some of the conditions that we see very prevalently are malaria, even much more than HIV/AIDS, but it doesn't get the attention it needs. Malaria and other waterborne diseases. The other issue we have a lot of contention around is sexuality education. We know there's a need for it, but there's a lot of contention around what is appropriate to impart to adolescents. And nevertheless, some NGOs have been able to develop some very specific services tailored to young people. And related to that, family planning services for women who are thinking of starting a family. And if you can just think of some of the statistics in this country around number of children and women being able to regulate their fertility, we're at a stage about, I would say, maybe three generations back on the African continent. And the fact that maybe some of the, like maybe your grandmothers or great-grandmothers, you know, had larger families, maybe didn't have access to contraception, but think of what access to the pill did. And think what that did also to enable women to also balance a career. And so those are still challenges on the African continent. And that leads to women often having a lot of children, and not enough care. And so the maternal mortality rates tend to be still high on the continent. And there's a large effort around training traditional birth attendants, knowing that a lot of women give birth in their communities to, not with nurses or midwives, but in their communities to women that they know that they've grown up around who are called traditional midwives, who come to their homes and help them deliver their children. But the idea is to actually impart stronger skills to these TBAs, especially such that they can identify complications. And if the complications exist, actually refer them to the appropriate skill technicians. And a piece of good news. There's actually been a decline in new HIV infections across the African continent, 25% decline. And that's, over about 15 years. And so there are targeted strategies to reach out to young people, to, you know, special populations, to really get the information out there. And so we're seeing some good outcomes, but more needs to be done. But from what I've told you, you can see that there's a gap in services between services when a mother, someone gives birth, and a child, you know, like 1 through 5, 0 through 5. But then the services don't really become stronger or defined until you're ready to give birth again, until that person becomes an adult, becomes a reproductive age. So there's a gap there. The new issues that are emerging and that need attention are issues such as cancer, hypertension, diabetes. There's not enough attention to those. There needs to be a lot more on preventive services and also environmental health. The African continent is rich in natural resources, but the process of extracting them is not very user-friendly, not very people-friendly. And so you see a lot of conditions that emerge out of the fact that the various industries and mining concessions, et cetera, oil, are not doing things in such a way where people's health can be protected. So you see a lot of respiratory illnesses. Now the approaches from the women's movement have been very holistic. They have really tried to look at people's complete sphere of life and really see, you know, how you can bring services to people as opposed to waiting for people to come to the health centers. So we have this tradition of community health educators that have been trained in many, many communities to be able to provide primary health services as well as education. So there's a lot of popular education happening that way, and also training young people, adolescents, to be peer educators. You see some of this also here in the U.S. There are economic empowerment strategies to make sure people can actually pay for the services since they're at cost. So when you're thinking of access to health, you have to think about how people are going to pay for them. There's been a strategy to make sure to link the HIV services with gender-based violence counseling, such that PEP services, the post-exposure prophylactics, are provided to women who have been victims of GBV, and to educate people about the link about that. There are a lot of efforts to develop mobile clinics, and to also do work around the link between early marriage and reproductive health outcomes, to look at providing services even in markets, looking at how do we improve the quality of food that people eat, knowing that a lot of mechanized and processed foods is coming onto the continent, and so a really emphasis on organic farming, you know, the farming that we used to do, and that is healthy. And also workplace education on HIV/AIDS. So these are some of the approaches. But I think we also need to think of some of the structural shifts that need to happen as well. Some of the structural shifts with regards to how aid agreements are made, or what kind of debt programs exist. If African countries are constantly trying to pay down their debt, and have been provided loans maybe to previous regimes that were not responsible in paying back those loans, that means the current generation is burdened with that. And as long as that happens, then the current governments are paying a large part of their national budgets annually to forgive debts, to pay debts. And so there are movements to actually forgive debts as opposed to making populations continue to pay for them. The link between U.S. foreign policy and sexuality education is very, very strong. There's been what's called the global gag rule, which puts restrictions on the use of foreign aid with regards to services for family planning. And so there's a need also to sort of see what are the implications for government aid, but also some of the messages that sometimes happen from very conservative forces, some conservative churches also from the U.S. that also have an influence on the kinds of sexuality education and health services that are provided on the continent. The one of the innovations we've seen to get information to people is through online services and online strategies. And so there are some NGOs that are being very, very creative to either have either online services or mobile technology, actually, to provide health information and access to referrals. I'll end with some global initiatives. Many of you might be knowledgeable about some of the accords that have happened around healthcare and women's health in particular. The International Conference on Population and Development several years ago, which developed some specific benchmarks about what countries should do to make sure that women's health becomes a human right, is appreciated and taken as a human right, and that various countries have various steps to take in order to meet that. So every 5 years, there are conferences to sort of see, you know, where we are on that. And at the regional level, the African Union of our African presidents has developed an instrument called the Protocol on the Rights of Women. It's extremely progressive. It's extremely progressive and talks about all types of various rights for women, including sexual and reproductive health rights. And within that, there's also a commitment that African presidents are actually going to shift their budgets eventually to having 15%, at least 15% of the budget allocated to health. Right now, in some countries, it's anywhere from maybe 3 to 8%. It depends on the country, but it tends to be very, very minimal. It tends to be very, very minimal. So there's a strong pressure from civil society groups to make sure that the national governments actually move up to the 15% that they have promised at the regional level. There are gender policies, there are reproductive health policies that have been implemented at the national level that women's groups are trying to actually put teeth into so that they're actually implemented. Some of the countries that have been able to do some innovative things in Sierra Leone, there are free services for pregnant women and for their children up to the age 5. And what you find is that you do see some better indicators around maternal health and also around infant mortality as a result of that. And you also see women from neighboring countries coming over to get those free services. They've heard about it. And so in Botswana also, they have a very strong program for HIV/AIDS services, and they're known for that. Let me end by saying that there are a series of conferences called Women Deliver that happen every 3 years, and the most recent happened last month in Malaysia. And there were over 4,000 delegates from what I heard. But these conferences, which happen in different places, are intended for civil society to come together and share best practices, but also to deliver some recommendations to governments to hold them accountable. And so there are government representatives there, there are various sectors, private sector, how they can actually work together to improve health outcomes around the world. It's very difficult for us as a planet, as Berkeley knows very well. If you don't have healthy people, how can you achieve development outcomes? You know, but even before that, just to respect the dignity of all human beings and make sure that human beings have access to health care. Thank you.
Thanks so much. I'm going to bring a few chairs up here and ask the three of you to come up. And then we'll open it up to question and answer. And since this session is being recorded, I'll just ask that we pass the mic to whoever is speaking. Is there anyone that wants to start us off with a question? Go ahead.
I have a question. You touched briefly. I mean, I understand the problem with the third world or majority world debt to the, you know, to the Western world. And I've heard a little bit about loan forgiveness, but you touched on that briefly. Could you expand? Is it that the pressure is coming from the World Bank, the debt holders, to cut services because they want to be repaid? Or what is it? You said something about co-paying and stuff. How is that working?
Could you summarize the question for the recording just so we get it on there as well?
Yes. So the question was to give more detail with regards to the question of debt forgiveness and the original loans which were provided by the World Bank.
And how that's impacting currently.
Yes, and how that's impacting current services on the continent. And it's definitely a topic for a longer day, but one of the strategies for development on the continent post-independence was to enable African governments actually to have the resources to be able to achieve the kinds of outcomes in various sectors. And in the first decade, after in the 60s, you saw a lot of investment in the public sector. You saw a lot of investments. But in the 70s and part of the 80s, part of a condition that came about in World Bank loans through what's called structural adjustment programs was that we actually needed to retrench the role of the state, that the state actually needed to take a step back, and we actually needed to see more private sector investment. We needed to see more of a free market model operate, whether it's in the economy or whether it's in the healthcare as well. And so the implications of that are that as a condition of receiving additional loans, then African governments had to actually sign on that they would allocate less towards education and health. And today, there are reflections. I mean, the past 10 years, there have been reflections on whether that has worked or not, and there have been many, many studies showing the negative implications of that. Now, we had some leaders on the continent that were not necessarily chosen by us, you know, chosen by the people. And so if we have loans that are being given to the country, but then being pocketed, the social movements are saying, why should we pay them back? Because they were being pocketed and misused with the full knowledge of the World Bank, with the full knowledge of the World Bank. And so the Jubilee Campaign and others have been working for a very long time to say that this was a global. I'm trying to be. Okay, thank you. A global mistake. It was a global mistake, and so we need to have debt forgiveness. And so in some countries that's been done. In some countries there have been, you know, instead of owing, say, $2 billion, it's been reduced to $1 billion. But in some countries those have not been negotiated at all. And as long as countries have to pay back those loans on an annual basis, then it means less money having to go into health and services people need.
I don't have your experience at all, but I've spoken and practiced in Africa, Southeast Asia, India, and even Eastern Europe. And a sad thing is that that healthcare has really got caught up in the whole East-West thing, and so socialism equals communism, and you know, so all there's this underlying agenda about. Private enterprise and the like, that I think we as Christians need to face up to. And it's very sad to go to India, for example, and see them, or Poland, when it was first opened up. I lectured right after it was opened up. And they're kind of we're just coming out of an era where we're starting to realize that we have to work on this healthcare project collectively. But they seem to be coming like at us from when we're in the 60s, and all this free enterprise and people go to individual clinics that are operated by doctors and their entrepreneurial efforts, and money's being put back into that as if they have to kind of go through this whole thing before they can get to the enlightenment that we're now just barely coming to in our country. So. It's all caught up in ideology, but I think, as you said, it is sad to see problems that need to be dealt with in a corporate, governmental, or at least corporate way, funneled in through this system in which it has to be done through kind of a private enterprise model, when that model really hasn't worked, and we're really seeing it not working with us. So it's been kind of interesting.
You're right.
You touched on it.
Yes, that would be my concern, having heard that, because actually I do a lot of work around HIV services, and I'm involved in some national organizations, including Positive Women's Network, USA. And, the issues are becoming, now that the United States is in financial crisis, supposedly, and we're having all our services cut here, that also means in PEPFAR is one of those services. Mm-hmm. So now the big debate coming from Americans, including the American public, is we have, if you take, since my major field is HIV/AIDS, if we have people that are waiting lists for medications and services here,
yes.
It will be a difficult sell to get debt forgiveness on money that we've lent to other countries when we can't get that. There's a lot of, American poor people that have health care and stuff or this government money, and we can't get that forgiveness here.
Right.
So actually, ultimately, because I might as well get this in now while I have my... what is it exactly that you all are wanting from us as a church? Because there's a lot of people already, because my main thing is, I'm looking to be able to find out how can I work on both issues, work on, have Christ at the core of what I do politically anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So what would that be from us as a church?
That's a very good question. And as a person of faith, I think that, it's something that we need to practice our faith. And so the role of individuals as voters is very, very important. You mentioned some policies that many Americans are not aware of. I think Americans in general need to educate themselves about U.S. foreign policy, about the various aid programs and their implications, and be knowledgeable about the local programs as well. If we don't have enough people advocating and putting pressure, then a lot of things would happen just without a lot of public input. And I think there's a lot less pressure today than there used to be on social issues, and there's a lot less awareness of the implications of U.S. policy overseas. And to the extent that there are educational sessions like this in churches, it is very, very critical for that to happen. And people need to also think about other policies, such as the Farm Bill or others. What does that have to do with health? What does that have to do with human rights? How is it implemented here in the U.S.? How are agricultural policies implemented overseas? And what are the implications for health outcomes on both sides of the ocean? And so awareness on international issues needs to be increased incredibly across the U.S. and the importance of taking action on those issues.
I just think somehow as a church, individually, corporately, we need somehow... whatever it is about America has been conflated with what it is to be a Christian. We got to separate those two things out. There is Christianity and there is what a Christian is, and then there's public policy. And sometimes those two match up and sometimes they don't. And I think we need to stand up for what it is to be a Christian. And not conflate it with what it is to be an American or what it is to be a Republican or a Democrat or whatever. Those have nothing to do with each other. You need to make it your business to turn off Fox News and MSNBC and whatever you're plugged into and really figure it out. Really figure it out. It's hard. It's hard on a lot of different levels, and stand up for it and not be cowed by... this thing that's going on, because people are suffering like crazy, and we in this in Berkeley, in Oakland, in California, in the United States, in the world, and the people are suffering have more in common than you would imagine. Thank you. Well, the question is, Chris brought up a case of somebody that was undocumented, and we found a hole in his heart that needed to have therapy. It was the kind of thing that day to day he was fine, but when he's 40, he's going to have some big problems if that's not fixed. It should have been fixed when he was a kid. Now, in his particular case,
He wasn't aware of it.
They found it, and smart, going to community college.
Big blow that morning to him.
Yeah. And, you know, I called all over, and I couldn't get anything for him. I mean, there's nobody you see. There's just no place for him. So I think what he ended up doing, he was going back to El Salvador and see if he could figure it out. In the case of the kid that got the heart transplant, I mean, that was more of who's on the list. I mean, that started out, I mean, he came in a wreck. You know, he had just been at John Muir Hospital and sort of was sent out, like, here's your 30 medicines, bye, you know. And he got plugged in the clinic. We saw him in our free clinic.
He came initially, a friend came with him. And his friend was very faithful. His friend would come with him. This gentleman is in his...
He's 31. He stopped drinking totally.
Yeah.
I started seeing him with his wife and little child. And he was on for about a year medical management and didn't get that much better in terms of his heart, but clinically he was better. He was not drinking. I plugged him in. I worked with him in La Clinica, and we got him Medi-Cal. We got him total disability, which got him Medi-Cal. Then I was seen in my office. And from Medi-Cal, I could call over to, you know, my friend at UC who's in the director of the heart transplant program, and we got him in the heart transplant program. But that took a lot for something that...
He's
very excited about that. His wife's excited about it. I mean, they realize what's ahead of them, but he's on the list. He'll get a heart. But he at least had a hold on things because he was an American citizen.
Examples are very powerful. Taking what you see, what are the key changes? Well, we're also talking about the public versus the private sector, and really both are important. You're, as La Clinica, you're in the private sector. It's not a public institution, so obviously it has an important role to play. So we need both. We need strength in both areas in terms of provision for healthcare in the public realm. What are some of the key changes that you, from your vantage point, would like to see in the public sector and then in the private sector? There's a lot of public discourse and public debate, and you've said we need to be, I feel very uninformed, but what do you think are some of the key changes that you'd like to see that would really help this? And obviously, any of your answers.
Well, I hate to get into that kind of thing, but we need to do this together. And any voices that... I mean, you have to start from one position, and my personal position, Chris's personal position, is that healthcare is a right.
But it helps to hear you say that.
It's a matter of opinion, and so it sort of stems from that.
Right, okay.
And if you believe that, then you start looking at things, and how is this that? And, you can't... Like the Affordable Care Act, okay? That thing's a poor, tortured beast, you know? But it's a start. And it's a start, you know? And it puts a lot more people on the Medi-Cal roll, so it puts much more money. Now, you say, you know, La Clinica is private, but it only exists because of public grants.
Exactly.
And so it's not really private.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to need more, and the Affordable Care Act puts money into places like La Clinica. Asian Health is a huge, very similar organization that one of my partners is involved with. He's a Christian. And he does a similar thing with them. And they are very, they're like that. But these are funded by the enterprise of the Affordable Care Act, which puts money in the hands of these kinds of organizations. So that's where you need, I mean, it's not perfect, but at least they're getting funding for that, and it's trying to channel things in that kind of direction. Just as an example, when you hear people trashing the Affordable Care Act, it's not perfect, but, you know, it still needs a lot of work, but it needs to work in a direction away from, towards this kind of thing and away from people seeing, well, that's death panels and we don't want to do that and we, you know, I've talked too much.
No, I think it's been very helpful. And, you know, just to underscore that there are a lot of publicly supported nonprofits or community organizations that really need the support of people who care, such as you. You know, whether those organizations exist here in the U.S. or whether they exist overseas, there are a lot that are not supported neither by industry, neither by government, but who do fundraising on an annual basis to try to provide services. And the other strategy is to actually bring the services into communities and to focus on preventive care and looking at what are all of those other factors that really drive some of those conditions that become endemic on the national scale. How can you really educate people such that they adopt healthier lifestyles?
I was just going to say that one of the things, going back to you saying about the vote, is, you know, one of the reasons why HIV/AIDS services is stronger in this country is actually, you know, whether we like to admit it or not, it's because of political action. Mm-hmm. It's because people got together in strength and in total numbers and demanded and pushed, and we're all people who vote. Mm-hmm. We are people that are in Sacramento and in Washington saying that we want this money to go in this direction. That's and they weren't all just, everybody with HIV is not poor and illiterate, and neither is everybody with heart disease. There's all kinds of other diseases that I frankly feel like do need the same kind of strength and services as the people with HIV have been able to get. But people have to stand up and demand it.
Yes.
And we're lucky because we're in a democracy. We can do that.
Yeah.
You know, we can do that. You know, we can do that. We can get what we want. We can get the money shifted where we want it just by saying, you know, if you don't make this the focus of where the budget goes, then we're not going to vote for you. We're not going to keep paying you. And I think it's just a matter, it's a matter of political will, and we have the numbers to determine the will. You know, so if we're not, so if we are going to separate out the church from the political, then, you know, then the political way that it actually works is numbers. It's numbers and strength and persistence.
I have a question kind of moving to the next level of, like, engagement. It's really for Dave and Chris. What for you guys, we talked about policy and political change, could you paint a picture of what healthy church engagement looks like with this issue? On a pragmatic level, I understand the political and policy, but what might that look like more practically?
Chris has a lot to say, but she's not feeling very well this morning, but she's... Well, I'm sorry. The question is, what is the church's role in this? And the church's role, I think, is in the really, really difficult middle ground. And I don't think, and I think we really have to stop being hijacked by... certain things. I'll say it. Abortion. you know, the whole HIV / gays thing. I can remember when gays first, when AIDS first hit, and I was in practice when it hit, and we didn't know what it, I was in training from the moment we didn't know what the heck this. Chris has a lot of experience in this practice in San Francisco. From what is this horrible thing, to understanding it. It was all like in with 2 or 3 years, you know, and I can remember going to a meeting and, you know, having a Christian guy who I didn't really know that well, who was kind of an internet, we were kind of in the same sort of international, we did this thing called angioplasty, and so we were at this special meeting, we were kind of early kind of people, and we were kind of meeting over this, and I knew, I happened to know he's a Christian, and so we went to church together, and I can remember him kind of checking out what my take was on AIDS. This is like 1983, 1984. And it was a litmus test. And he, you know, if I didn't think that this was the devil's punishment, he was kind of going to start to evangelize me. I'll never forget it. And that kind of stuff, we need to get out of that. And we and it's corny, but we got to do the whole what would Jesus do thing. I mean, what would Jesus do? And I think, yeah, government's a mess. Yeah, the post office is crappy. Yeah, DMV's a mess. And, you know, the government messes up everything. Yeah. I get that. I get it's the most, not the most efficient. And, yeah, maybe, like, get a job kind of thing. But at some point, you have to err on the side of alleviating suffering. That's, you know, what would you do with your kid? You know, when you're in that moment with your teenager or your 23-year-old, and is it time for tough love and you're just willing to see him out in the street? Or do you continue helping him, hoping that he's going to make it? It's that kind of thing. And those aren't easy kind of discussions. And it's not easy to create policy around that kind of emotional thing. But as a starting point, you have to err on the side of justice, and you have to err on the side of being liberal. You know, that's not a very good answer. But
what might we do with that insight?
Well, I think like she says, you know, separated away from the church, I think we need to be having forums like this and voting such that Christianity isn't in the pocket of one particular side of the argument, which it is right now. It is. I mean, we're on the wrong side of justice. And if we changed, that would be huge. If the people in Florida couldn't count on that, it would be huge. If the Christians did the what would Jesus do?
The church is actually outside of Western countries as mm-hmm. far as sheer numbers go, mm-hmm. but a lot of the money and power is mm-hmm. still with Western churches.
Yes, yes.
And just the what would the healthy response of the church be mm-hmm. given those dynamics?
The church definitely has a lot of power, and there are a lot of very conservative churches in particular who have taken hold on the African continent, and we are very believing as Africans. We are very believing, very trusting, and I always say we need to be much more critical. So I think that we need to build those critical thinking skills and those questioning skills and not just welcome any foreigner that comes in just because they're a foreigner. And often there's that naivety, that happens, and so that's one piece. The other piece is to understand that when there's so much suffering on other areas of life, then faith is the thing that people grab onto, and so even if it's an extremist messaging, then it's still there. It grabs hold. It grabs hold because people feel like, okay, well, that's something that they can count on. And some of these churches provide a lot of different outreach programs. They provide various services. And so there needs to be the counterface that actually intercedes as well. And sometimes maybe there are those more progressive churches and movements that are partnering with churches overseas, but they're not in the media the same way as the more conservative churches are. So the image of the conservative church influencing a lot of public policy and social dynamics on the continent is quite strong.
Such as?
Well, for example, in Uganda, with the LGBT, there have been several bills on the continent around anti-homosexuality, around even talking about abortion, even talking about access to contraception. And, I mean, in this country, it's a right. Anybody can have access to contraception. But overseas, for some reason, it's as if, no, it's against God's will. I mean, come on. We have to be open-minded. We have to be very open-minded.
Just to make a comment, I think it's very easy to lose hope when it comes to educational and health equality and fairness. And we've come a long way as a world people from when a lot of people were in indentured servitude, if not slavery, and we're moving out of that. But I think that we need to know that we're in a long struggle here. And to me, we're closer to 1800 when it comes to abolition than we are to the 16th or whatever, 14th Amendment, which is law but not actually implemented. And that we have to realize that it is a matter of prayer and faith and being faithful. We need to learn to be more faithful, but we're just in one moment in time that we're at least in a 30-year struggle, if not a 100-year struggle, for education, health care to be provided to the majority of the world's people, not alone a slim minority. And so we have to be hopeful, and that we need to be in there, and that we're just one little part. And we can be a part of the answer.
That's right.
On that hopeful note, I'm wondering if you've seen, I've seen about the African Union Protocol on Rights for Women, mm-hmm. and there's so many barriers to healthcare, in particular for women on the continent of Africa. Have you seen anything along the lines of that having an impact around women's access to healthcare or any innovative things like microinsurance?
Yes, there are a lot of innovations that are happening. I mean, there's a lot of advocacy on the part of women's organizations to really make sure that their governments are aware, that the women's movement is aware of what they're signing all over the place. I mean, they're not just signing it in the African Union. They're signing it at the UN. They're signing it this protocol and that protocol. And if they think that the population is ignorant and not going to hold them accountable, then they're not going to do anything about it. So the advocacy on the part of social movements is so important, and women's movements are doing that. And at the same time, yes, you do have innovations such as microinsurance programs. So this would run very similar as microcredit, but instead of that funding being for business purposes or economic purposes, it would be money collected every month and held until somebody needs it for a healthcare need. And so those are some of the ideas. Thinking of prevention, the message that a lot of community organizations are doing is make sure you go for preventive care. Don't wait until there's a problem. Don't wait until things get critical. And you know, to get people to start doing screenings for high blood pressure, to start doing screenings for cancer, to you know, have mobile clinics available for HIV, and actually to integrate the HIV services with other services such that there's not the stigma of going to an HIV clinic. And as I said earlier, the number of new infections has actually gone down significantly across the continent. So that is a piece of good news. People have changed behavior.
You know, the wacko thing about this whole thing is that, I mean, if you were the most conservative fiscal person in the world and the most brilliant, and you analyze the whole situation, you'd be all over this healthcare issue in terms of it as an engine for cost benefit in terms of an engine for improvement. I mean, you'd be all over it. I mean, I try to explain to people like, well, so imagine you're the governor of California and we have this big budget problem and you decide that, okay, the way we're going to handle this is we're not going to change the oil or do any maintenance on any state vehicle this year. Well, that wouldn't make any sense. That would be an incredibly expensive thing to do. But if you could deal in a structured, organized, user-friendly way, if you could deal with hypertension in Oakland, okay, and really cure that, make it as easy and as fundamental. I mean, that would be such, you know, for a nickel a day in medicine, okay, you could save people. I mean, if you have untreated hypertension in Oakland, this is what happens. You have hypertension, and it goes untreated till you're about 35 or 42. And then you go in kidney failure, and then you're on total disability, and you get lifelong dialysis according to a federal program. Okay, that's if you didn't get a stroke first, and now you're in a nursing home because you're hemiplegic. Okay, and because of the healthcare system, now that you're on disability, and now that you're in the system, you will live till you're probably about 66. Okay, now you compare that road with really getting good therapy for that person from a very young age and treating their high blood pressure, which will end up costing about, like, you know, $7,000 as opposed to the other thing that I outlined. I mean, any economist would look at that and say, this is nuts the way you're doing this.
I just want to thank you all so much for being here and for what you shared. One of the things I've really loved about First Press, I've been attending here since about 2006, is just I loved that I came here and not everybody was the same as me. Not everybody thought like I did and had the same politics I did. And years ago when Mark Laverton was still here, he had the session stand up and divide across this room, actually. If you were on the left politically, to go over there. If you were on the right politically, to go over there. And if you were kind of somewhere in the middle, to stay in the middle. And it was exactly a third, a third, a third. And I just love that story because I love that what we come together around is not our politics or our culture, but it's our faith. And that this initiative in particular really started out of looking at the life of Jesus and that he was constantly reaching out to people on the fringes and the margins and seeking justice for them. And so I love that we can have discussions like this and know that they're rooted in that desire to see justice done in the world, really through our church and through our belief in Christ. So thank you so much for being here and for being part of this discussion. I hope you come back next week. We'll be talking about microfinance and development, and Kathy will be with us for that. And we'll have another speaker, Tess, who works with an organization in San Francisco. And so with that, Mary Ellen, I saw you slip in. Do you want to close us in prayer?
They end itself. Let's join in prayer. Lord, we thank you so much for this day of worship, this opportunity to learn, to be engaged in these issues here and around the world. And so we pray a special prayer for our speakers, Lord, that your Holy Spirit would surround them, encourage them in those moments of despair or frustration. And we pray that you would, by your Spirit, encourage them on this road as they lead us also. So be with us as we go from this place. We are grateful for your love for us. We pray in your name. Amen.